But I would like to focus on, in the meditation, like I said, creation and God's plan for the family. Because when God made Adam and Eve, he was making a community. Right off the bat, part, like we said earlier, being made in the image and likeness of God meant that we are not made just as individuals, but we were made for relationships. And in so doing, God was making us in the image of the Holy Trinity. That's, as with so many analogies, the word analogy implies that there's something similar and something different, right? It's not an exact parallel. In this analogy of the family, you, husbands, men, take the part of God the Father. Okay, you represent God the Father in the family image. And God the Father is the source, if you wish, from which the Trinity flows. Now, you always have to be delicate with Trinitarian theology, because if you use the wrong word, then you become a heretic and you get burned. The word that they tend to use in theology is that the Son and the Holy Spirit proceed from the Father. Okay? He doesn't generate them, and this is not something chronological because it's outside of time. The Holy Spirit always was and always will be. Jesus always was and always will be, but in some way that nobody but God himself understands. God the Father is the source and origin of all being. And kind of the idea is God, who is pure spirit, in which to know and to love are the same thing, in the contemplation of himself being the source of all that is perfect and all that is beautiful and all that is wonderful and in possibility even, looking upon himself and seeing all this perfection, his own thought is of such a depth and such an extent that it becomes a perfect reflection of himself. And that thought is called the Logos, right? The Word. That thought that God the Father has of himself is God the Son. Fullness of being. Absolute, perfect, in every sense of the word, the image of the Father. And the mutual love and admiration and bond between the Father and the Son is of an absolute total perfection, lacking nothing, which is and becomes is the Holy Spirit. He is the bond of love between the Father and the Son. And so, again, to us, we only kind of vaguely get it. And God, I don't even think the angels really understand. They know it's there. They admire it. But I think only God really gets how it all works. And that's fine. We don't need to. But God chose to make us in that image. So for us, it's kind of easy. We represent God the Father as men. It's like, okay, I can deal with that. A little bit harder for the women, because the woman, the spouse then, would actually represent God the Son. Now, if you understand the Son, quote-unquote, in terms of logos, the reflection, somebody who is distinct from the Father, but nonetheless has all of the perfections and is of equal dignity, in that sense, you can say your wife is like that. She is distinct from you as a person, has the same dignity. And in an ideal world, you know, both of you together with that same love, that love is something that is not only, I don't want to say selfish, but it's not only focused just exclusively on one person, but it becomes a love that is procreative, so to speak. In Trinitarian theology, you would say generative, and from that stems the Holy Spirit, who represents the children in a family, okay? And again, we can only vaguely image the Trinity, but God was very intentional when he made us that way. He made us where one man and one woman will fall in love and each one will complement each other. Now, one of the differences between us and the Trinity is that the Trinity, each person is lacking absolutely nothing. There is no perfection that one lacks. The only difference between the different individuals of the Trinity is the difference of relationship that they have. In humanity, each one of us, God makes us and men tend to be good at certain things and women tend to be good at other things. And within that, you know, this particular man has his characteristics, your strengths and your weaknesses and your qualities. And this particular woman has her strengths and weaknesses and qualities. And together you are meant to harmonize and complement each other. And the same thing will be true of the children that come from that relationship. So God's plan for us then, like I said, is that we are made in a relationship where we are images of the Holy Trinity itself. And you think about that, when you think about my family is called to be an image of Almighty, of the Trinity. That is the ideal. That is our calling, and that is the function of my family. Now, even though in the spiritual exercises we have not yet arrived to Satan or the fall, you know, I have to keep making mention of him because, frankly speaking, we live that reality every day. Precisely because our families are made in the image of the Trinity, Satan wants to destroy. He hates the family because it reflects the Trinity that he abhors. And he wants to destroy it, and he will do absolutely anything he can. And if we look at today's society, tell me if there is an institution that is more attacked than the family. And he attacks each one of us. He attacks manhood because we are the image of the Father, the source of everything. And in many regards, we're also the image of Jesus Christ. Christ became man, right? He became one of us. So again, Christ, as members of the church, these, you know, each analogy is, it's not good to mix analogies, but the difference when Christ chose to betroth himself to the church, well, in that analogy, we represent Christ and the church represents the bride and the spouse, okay? So in that regard, then we reflect Jesus Christ. And again, Satan cannot, he abhors anything that is a reflection of any of the persons of the Trinity. So he's on a rampage against the family. But the reality is, if we want to fulfill our vocations to become saints, as married men especially, then the school and the setting is going to be more than anything in the family. I mentioned that you guys spend a lot of your time working, but even more fundamentally to you, you could change jobs and, you know, in a sense, it's not that big a deal. You guys probably at any number of points in your lives have changed careers, at least a couple of different stops. And I'm not just talking about when you were a high school kid and you flipped burgers. You know, it's not uncommon that somebody studies one thing, decide they didn't really study the right thing, they want to study something else, and then they get a job here, and then somewhere along the line something opens up and they decide to go to some completely different angle. That's not uncommon, okay? You can't do that with your family, not legitimately. Sometimes we do it, it doesn't work, but your family is not meant to be, you know, I'm changing families now. This one was pretty good for the last 15 years, but I'm changing up. That's not the way it's called to be. Your family is called to be you and your wife. It's till death do you part. Interesting that it's not eternal. It is provisional. It's only something in this life. And why is that? Well, and this goes towards actually one of the readings you actually have there. In the Catechism of the Catholic Church, number 1601, it says the matrimonial covenant is a loaded word, by which a man and a woman establish between themselves a partnership of the whole life, is by its nature ordered toward the good of spouses and procreation and education of offspring. What is a covenant? Covenant is, it is a contract, so it's a legally binding contract, but it's legally not in terms of society is necessarily going to be the one to fulfill the obligation. It is legally binding before God. You call God into the equation, and you're saying, before God, two people or individuals or tribes or nations or whatever are going to, before God, unite ourselves to become a family. That is what a covenant is. So when God made the covenant with Israel, he says, you are going to become my children. We will enter into a marriage bond, and you will become, in a sense, family to me. So God was really tremendously condescending when he offers covenants over and over again to Israel, saying, you will be mine. I'm going to give you special privileges. You are family to me. And therefore, like a spouse, that's why he's always complaining about Israel, you're an unfaithful spouse. Well, I mean, if you're married to somebody and every time you turn around, she's chasing after somebody else, it's like, well, there's something wrong here with this marriage, right? But that's the way that God looks at this. And when you get married to your wife, then you're entering into a covenant and you're saying the two, through the grace of God, the two will become one. And like I said earlier today, not just for the sake of becoming one with each other so that you can have a great time. That's part of it. You will love each other and hopefully rejoice in each other's presence and rejoice in the treasures that you find in the one that you love. But part of it is you will not, like I said, it's not a matter, from now on, you will no longer seek to be saints as individuals, but you will seek to be saints as a couple and eventually as a family, as a unit. Each one of you will help each other in your relationship with God. And the way that it works is, ultimately, is because the family is designed to be a school of charity, a school of love. And wherever, we know that God is love, right? So wherever there is authentic love, even in weird situations, this is a parenthesis, but I think, you know, Pope Francis lately with the whole thing about can the church bless homosexual couples? Well, you can bless the members of the couple, but not the relationship as such, because the relationship is disordered. But nonetheless, we can't deny that in some of these arrangements, we have people that there's, very often there's some element of love, some element of, it can be twisted or corrupted or whatever, but there's something there where there's something noble to work with. There's some touch of, you know, commitment to one another that is authentic. It's a participation in God's love that he can work with. The school is meant to be the school, the family is meant to be the school of love, where we have all kinds of different relationships. And this is why we're able to build loving societies. You think about it, you have the love that you have for your wife is different than the love she has for you. So you have, they're very similar, there's a bond, but you know, she loves you in a different way than you love her, partially because you're a man and she's a woman, partially because you're two individuals. But nonetheless, your love for each other is, there's a something unique and something similar at the same time. The love that you have for your children is different than the love that they have for you. They're all authentic. The love that your children have for one another is different again from the love that they have for you or that you have for any of the individuals. So you've got all these different kinds of relationships of love. And then when you have an extended family, cousins and relatives, and then eventually you form neighborhoods and communities. And again, all of these in God's plan are meant to be different ways in which his essence is reflected. When we spoke earlier in one of the meditations on creation, the fact that all of created reality, the pine trees and the beauty of nature and all that, it's a reflection of God. Well, human relationships, much more so. We are reflections of and participation in God's plan to love. What his whole goal in creating humanity is to create physical beings that are capable of loving. So not only pure spirits like angels can love God, but also, you know, only he could invent something like matter. I'm sure the angels are like, what's he doing here? What's that inanimate stuff that he's making? What good is that? Well, because he wanted there to be a new way, something new that could express love for him. And now we are the priests, so to speak, of all of the cosmos, because we are material beings that are capable of loving. And again, this is what the family is designed to be, that school of love where different kind of dimensions of God's love are reflected. Obviously, the family of fallen men and women, you know, sometimes you come home and it feels like it's anything but love. The kids are arguing and fighting, and then this one's not talking, and this one broke something, and your wife is nagging you, and you're mad, whatever, you know. So again, the devil is there because he hates the family, but ideally speaking, this is what the family is designed to be. And for the most part, I would say there's always more good in it than there is bad. For as bad as you think your family is, there's still generally going to be, there's more good in it, okay? In a family and in a marriage, I said earlier that the two of you, you and your wife, will no longer, you're no longer called to love God just as kind of individuals, but you're called now to love each other as a couple. It was a beautiful image. Actually, Father John Connor uses this one. If you take a look at a pyramid, right? You got, if you're in one bottom corner and your wife is in the other bottom corner, and both of you, the closer you get to God, what happens to each other? You get closer to each other in the process, right? So the more you are working on your spiritual life and the more that you are growing closer to God as an individual, the closer you will also draw to your spouse. The reverse you could also say is true. The closer you are drawing to your spouse, the more energy and effort you put into loving your spouse authentically, the closer you will be drawing to God. Because God is love, so any authentic participation in love is always a participation in Him. Now, there is an order and a hierarchy of loves in the family. And this is one that we, by nature, tend to get wrong. You did not marry your children. You married your spouse. And so the hierarchy of loves, according to the plan of God, is love God first because He's God. He is the perfection and fullness and the source of everything that is lovable, comes from Him. When you enter into this covenant of love with your spouse, you are saying, out of all of the other women, out of all the other human beings, really, especially out of all the other women out there, you are the one that I am going to consecrate my life to, and the two will become one, and we will walk this journey together. And from that come children. So the proper hierarchy of loves, which we frequently get wrong, is, sounds bad because you don't want to say, well, I love you more than I love somebody else. But in a certain sense, you're called to love your spouse first and then your children. And a lot of the times we get it wrong because it's easier. And again, the devil's in there sticking his finger in there because he gets it. He knows that. We talked earlier about authority and structures of authority. Well, it's related to that. If you love, the greatest gift you can give to your kids, was one Hispanic lady I knew said it well. She said it in Spanish to me, but it was loving your spouse is the best way of loving your children. Okay? If you want to, kids will intuit if the couple is united in principles and united in love. United in principles in the sense that kids have this sixth sense to figure out who's the one who's going to give me what I want, right? When you have a couple that's a unified front and the kids come, Dad, can I do that? What did your mom say? Okay, after a while, they know it's hopeless. Dad is not going there. And mom and dad can consult among themselves behind closed doors what, you know, the rules are and what the kids are and are not allowed to do. But if the kids figure out that one of them is going to give me something easier than the other, oh, they're going to work that so well. And then that causes divisions, right? Because the kids are just, they figure out how to get what they want. They're not stupid. That's only going to happen when the couple truly loves each other. When a couple loves each other passionately, the kids subconsciously pick up on that, and that creates tremendous security in the household. So, and when it's not there, then we try to start, we realize our kids are starting to do weird things and act up and everything. And then we start trying to give them solutions like Disneyland or whatever that don't really solve the problem. When it's not there, no matter what you do, it's not really going to fix the problem. Okay. Then after that comes the love of your children immediately. And then after that, everybody else. Okay. And I think women in particular, that's a tricky point, because women in particular, they can get very possessive of the children. And sometimes they can get to a point where it's like your competition with the children, and they're like, no, us against you. And that's a very unhealthy place to be. However, they probably get that way if they already realize, if there's already a division. If we as men are loving our wives with all our heart and soul, then there won't be that, like, you know, I have to protect my children from you, you barbarian, just make money for me. As men, we are called to be the heads of our households. Again, not in an oppressive way, but I would say first and foremost in the faith. And this is where we, I just kind of picked on women, how they can very easily fall into the whole thing of loving the children more than their spouse. They will tend to that more easily than we will, I think. But we will very easily fall in our mission and duty to become the heads of the household, especially in the faith. I'm sure a lot of you have heard this before, but it always bears worth, or it always bears hearing again. And I don't have the numbers straight. I've got to find what the original numbers were. But there was a study done in some Scandinavian country back in the early 2000s. And it said essentially when both mom and dad go to religious services regularly, like pretty much every Sunday, I don't remember what the percentage was, but let's say it's like a 65% chance that your kids are going to end up going to religious services regularly. When only mom goes and dad doesn't, which sadly is the case very frequently, it dropped radically. It's like, you know, it goes from 65 to something like 30%. Now, the interesting one is when only dad goes and mom doesn't, instead of dropping, it actually went up slightly. Went from like, you know, 65 to 68 or something percent chance. And then if neither goes, then practically 0% chance that your kids are going to go to religious services on Sunday. I say religious services because I think it was some Scandinavian, like Lutheran country, but it seems to hold true across all faiths. Well, why is that? And it's not to say that the ideal situation is that dad goes and mom doesn't, because that's not true. What I think that means, though, is the role of the dad when, I think the circumstances spell out that when you have a dad that is strong enough in the faith that even if the wife isn't going, he's going to lead, then you've got a man who really lives his faith and he's living his leadership in the household. And I think when mom and dad both go, the law of averages, you get some dads that go, but they're more or less mediocre and whatnot. So probably they don't have as much influence. That would be my take on it. But it says something about us as men and as leaders, that this is what we are called to. If you look at the Old Testament, before Moses, you'll read something. It's like, before Moses, you'll have like Abraham or Jacob or these people. They would offer up sacrifices. They were performing a priestly function. There were no professional priests in the people of Israel until the covenant of Sinai, and frankly, the professional priestly class, and they weren't Catholic priests, they were the Jewish priests, but the professional priestly class was a punishment for the people of Israel because they weren't living up to it. So eventually God said, okay, I'm going to assure that now from now on you have somebody who's going to fulfill this duty, and the tribe of Aaron got chosen, and then from them came the priests of the people of Israel, okay? Interestingly enough, Catholic priests were completely from a different line. Jesus was not of the tribe of Aaron. And actually, when you get ordained a Catholic priest, you say you are of the order of Melchizedek. He was an interesting figure. He wasn't even a Jew. But he was this kind of mythical, eternal figure. The idea being that we go back to something primordial. As men, though, you're still called to be the priests of your family, which means your family is meant to be a church. And the priest's function is to offer up sacrifice to God, to be an intercessor on behalf of the family, or in your case, of the family. But a priest's function is to offer up sacrifices to God in reparation for sins and to intercede. You're a midpoint between God and humanity when you're a priest. So you bring the intentions and the needs of the people before God, and you bring the rights and the desires of God to the people, and you're that bridge, okay? As fathers, you are called to be that. As spouses and husbands, you are called to be that within your families. And most of us sadly, sadly fail in that regard. Usually it's the women running around saying, oh, nagging the kids. We have to pray the rosary, we have to get to Mass, and the kids are all rolling their eyes and everything. When a dad mans up and takes that faith, you don't get the rolling eyes and stuff. It's different. And your wife is less of a nag because she doesn't feel subconsciously like she has to be doing all this stuff, because she has the security of knowing it's covered. So this again seems to have turned into more of a talk than a meditation, but I wanted to give you these thoughts. You do have some texts here. You have the letter to the Ephesians, which talks about the relationship between husbands and wives. Now, I will admit, I do not find the letter to the Ephesians to be fun meditation. You know, St. Paul, it's not like reading a gospel parable where there's a story and you can enter into it and it's easy to pray about. If you want, you have some choices here. You can use Ephesians or these texts here if you're the intellectual sort and you want to go there. If you want, again, you can just kind of contemplate and imagine what the Holy Family would have been like with Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. Joseph taking the leadership. Interesting. The guy who was the least in the family, greatest among men aside from Jesus, but nonetheless, out of the three, he was the least. And nonetheless, his job was to lead. He had to lead God himself. Imagine that. And God obeyed. God made it that way.